Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is How to Behave on the Heritage Radio Network. This week, the Chinese government issued instructions on how its citizens should behave when traveling abroad. Spitting, littering, cutting in lines, and defacing historic treasures are all discouraged. According to a government post, being a civilized tourist is the obligation of each citizen. Thank you, China. Now if we can just get every other nation, especially our own, to issue behavioral guidelines to the citizens that travel abroad. A French tourist was told by a judge in New Zealand to behave after being caught shoplifting a pumice stone from a department store. And for some reason, this was in the news. Republican representative and Tea Party favorite Michelle Bachmann announced she was not going to run for re-election, disappointing comedians and late-night TV hosts everywhere. But what's bad for Jay Leno is good for America. New Jersey Senator Frank Lautenberg passed away today at the age of 89. And Jean Stapleton, the actress who portrayed Edith Bunker on All in the Family, passed away at the age of 90 last week. From 1971 to 1980, Edith tried to show her bigoted husband, Archie, how to behave, and in the process served as an example to millions of women who are also navigating a changing world. Speaking of a changing world, The Village Voice laid off food critic Robert Sietsema, along with two other prominent writers, gossip columnist Michael Musso and theater critic Michael Feingold. This came days after the paper's editor and deputy editor walked out in protest to the pending cuts. Who's left at The Village Voice? What newspapers are still publishing at all? How do you behave when you're a newspaper food writer in this changing media landscape? It's Monday, June 3rd, and we've got food writer Robert Sietsema himself here to talk about it, along with Melissa McCarty from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. I'm Brian Geiser. It's June 3rd, and this is How to Behave, the Down the Hatch show. Sorry to Melissa, I forgot to read my notes on that one.
That's okay.
Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
we're good. So we're here also with the woman who cares so much about this week's topic. That she became a food blogger, Hannah Howard.
Hi.
How are you, Hannah?
I'm great.
Good. The phone lines are open today, so if you're listening to the live stream at heritageradionetwork.org and want to join in the conversation, call us at 718-497-2128. So, Hannah, tell us quickly, what food writing have you done?
Ooh, I've done a lot of food writing. I wrote for my lovely college paper, and I write for Serious Eats. And
which college?
Columbia.
Oh, nice.
It wasn't really known for its food journalism, but I tried anyway. I tried my hand.
But known for its journalism.
Yeah, so that's true. I did a little stint there, and I wrote and write for Serious Eats, and cool. I'm employed as a food copywriter. So.
All right. So,
and what does that entail? Is that like a field I could get into?
Yeah.
It's good you bring that up, Robert, because I hear you're looking for a job.
Well, I'm now a freelancer, and I have a regular assignment for Eater New York. But, yeah, I have some spare time.
Yeah?
Okay. That I can spend writing instead of just eating.
How long were you with the Village Voice?
20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how did you end up there? What's the brief story on how you became a food writer and how you ended
I was
up there?
A rock musician. I did a fanzine called Down the Hatch, which was about eating ethnic food, cheap ethnic food in New York and in other places where my rock band traveled. And eventually somebody from The Voice said, hey, come on and try out being a food critic. So I did it. And it was very lucky because nowadays if you announce a job like that, there'd be thousands of people vying for it. But back then, there weren't that many people that wanted to be food critics.
You were just minding your own business.
Yeah, it was an accident. I have no inherent talent to do that, and I'd never thought of myself as a writer. I'd never really written anything but really bad term papers.
Well, you've become a better writer, I think.
Well, that goes without saying. Yes, I went from zero to one half or whatever.
Yeah, well, that's great. So, Melissa, tell us where you are and what you're doing.
Right now I'm at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette as their food critic, and I just started in August. Before that, I was in South Florida working for a Village Voice-owned paper, and then I got my start as D.C. Was growing as a restaurant town, and I was writing freelance for the Washington Post, Washingtonian, and Washington City Paper as the restaurant scene there was sort of growing, and now it's sort of at a peak of some sort. So.
Well, let's not forget one of your most important qualifications, that you taught at Stuyvesant High School.
I did.
Did you?
I did.
What did you teach?
I did. It was brief. I taught English. So I was a high school teacher for nearly a decade, and I started it at Stuyvesant, and I also taught in Westchester. But when I moved to Washington, I just committed more to freelance writing, and at the time, at 2008 or so, it was a major transition point in terms of newspapers and media, and so I filled in and did a lot of freelancing, and that's essentially how I moved into journalism at that point. And I had also worked in restaurants for quite a stint, both before teaching and for a stint after teaching.
So you specifically wanted to write about food when you got into journalism?
Definitely. Yeah. I am enamored with it.
And you're good at it, too.
Thank you.
So, Robert, it seems like you were a foodie in New York City before there was even a word for that.
Actually, the word was like coined in the 60s in England. But yes, before we all thought of ourselves as not being foodies. There was a hell of a lot of good food to eat all over a town, and there weren't too many people exploring it. There was no Yelp, there was no Chowhounds, so you kind of heard from word of mouth when some new Tibetan place opened, say, out in, you know, some far reach of Queens or something, and would hurry there just because you were so curious about the food. I grew up in the Midwest, so my early experiences were limited to meatloaf and instant mashed potatoes.
So when did you start falling in love with more exotic food than that?
When my parents gave my daughter a computer and we didn't know what to do with it, so I started doing this fanzine called Down the Hatch, which I surreptitiously Xeroxed at whatever horrible job I was working. Yeah. And could just send it out to people, and it kind of caught on, and it was kind of the forerunner of the modern food blog.
Yeah,
which I'm ashamed, of course.
I was Hannah and I were talking a few minutes ago about how it seems like your career has come full circle. Like, you started out doing a food blog when that was photocopied and stapled, and now you're back.
Yes, it feels back. Very comfortable. Every job is different, but this, you know, working for Eater is really fun because I get to kind of do what I originally did, which is to go out looking for good places to eat.
Yes.
It seems like the paradox is that, you know, you said 20 years ago there weren't hundreds of people vying for a food critic job, and now there are multitudes more, and at the same time, so significantly less of those jobs that actually exist.
Right, and the universities are unconscionably barfing out people with advanced degrees in food writing, believe it or not.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, yeah. And in related food master's degrees of various sorts, seeming to qualify them for writing about food. And really, the only thing that qualifies you to write about food is just taste and your willingness to waste time describing it.
How many people do you think in this country make their whole living writing about food?
About five, because everyone else is underpaid and scrambling to get by and working.
They're freelance. They're like Hannah. They do a blog, but they have another job.
They've busted it down so there are fewer actual food writing jobs that pay you a living than ever before, whereas masses of nearly unpaid food writers fill up the day's blogs. There's nothing wrong with that, of course. So, it's just a shift in the paradigm. It's like we have been socialized. We're sharing all of the money we used to make ourselves with everyone else. So.
Yeah.
Also, I think that a lot of papers, Washington City Paper is one of them, is moving towards looking at food writing as a business and culture beat in addition to writing about food. Initially, Washington City Paper's food critic had been had required for critics to be anonymous, and that's no longer the case. And then we saw with Seattle Weekly, with Hannah Raskin, how that position had changed from food critic to food editor as well, and she resigned as a result, because that wasn't something that she chose to embrace.
In other words, the X chain that, or the chain that both of us are ex-employees of, that is Village Voice Media, which is really New Times in disguise, who took over the Village Voice papers 6 years ago. Those people seem to be getting out of the food criticism business. I mean, if you look at the blogs, most of the blogs don't include actual descriptions and little mini reviews of restaurants, but rather just kind of notices that they've opened and kind of over-the-top descriptions of what they're serving without really being critical in any way.
And it sounds like what they're doing is replacing those of you who had very specific jobs, like the theater critic and broader, with people who are doing a bunch of things.
Exactly, and who are willing to do them for not very much money.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the days of the food critic are behind us?
No. Food critics spontaneously arise, kind of like toads out of the mud or whatever.
That's right.
What about the anonymous food critic who goes, you know, unbeknownst to the restaurateur?
Well, I'm still doing it, so, and so is Melissa. Melissa's got a fantastic job in Pittsburgh, one of the great food cities in the country, and she arrived there just at the right time.
Melissa, tell us a little bit about how you do your job. Like, are you undercover? Do you ever wear a disguise? Do you ever reveal your identity? Do you accept free things from the chef, stuff like that?
Well, first, I'm going to give a little bit of the context of the paper, and that is I started working for a paper that's really committed to the idea of criticism. There's a classical music critic, there's an art critic, there's a theater critic still, and it's culture of the arts and of food is something that's really important to the paper and I think the town. It's obviously much smaller than New York. I think the importance is to essentially act as if you're doing a service essentially for diners, where somebody might recognize me, but no, I don't accept free things. No, I'm not getting chummy with the guy who just opened a restaurant. And I look at how others around me are being treated as well as how my dining experience unfurled. So I think it's important when a restaurant recognizes a critic, for example, to perhaps have plants elsewhere in the restaurant, that might be having dinner and talking to them about their experience as well.
Yeah. So are you widely recognized by restaurant people? Like, I know in New York, the restaurants, I mean, I work in the restaurant business, and everybody has the photos of the New York Times critic and the other big critics up in the back, so everybody recognizes them when they come in.
Contingent plan should they arrive.
Yeah,
a play code by word. Play,
but
right.
How many restaurants can really carry that through? I mean, idle threat. I mean, even Pete Wells, the most recognized of them all, describes often going into restaurants and having no one recognize him. I mean, it's just, what place can afford to put, like, a critic recognizer at the door? And who can be always looking in?
I've worked at places, and I've heard of places that have things like, you know, $150 bonus to anybody who recognizes Frank Bruni or Pete Wells or whatever.
When I was a hostess, someone had shared a list of potential, I was in the Frank Bruni days,
right.
Of potential Frank Bruni phone numbers, and for every reservation we would have to, I mean, this was a list of like 30 numbers that he had apparently
and
once used.
And aliases from his credit cards.
And aliases, and we had to check every reservation. So,
you're talking about restaurants that have a massive structure of people doing this and that and the other thing. I mean, most restaurants, you just pick any restaurant in the West Village, walk in there, your chances of being recognized are nil.
But we're talking about the sort of restaurants that the New York Times has been reviewing for the last few years.
Right.
Not,
although they've changed.
They've gotten better.
But yeah, well, they've changed the constellation of places they review. I mean, Wells has gone out to all sorts of places that have been unexpected, you know, restaurants in the Bronx and in Queens and stuff.
Yeah. But sorry, Melissa, I think we asked a question that we didn't let you answer.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, I think it's hit and miss, and Robert just addressed it, that there are some restaurants that that's certainly a part of their structure, and they have photos in the kitchen and what have you, but then there are mom-and-pop places where I can go under the radar quite easily and several times, and it's not, they don't recognize me or even care necessarily.
Yeah.
The trick is in not acting like a critic. A lot of critics act like critics because they really want to be recognized.
How do you act like a critic?
Pompous, by talking, by swirling the wine around in a glass.
We actually talked about this on the show last week. The topic was dining alone, and we talked about how you can get really great service and extra stuff dining alone if you do all the things that make you look like a critic.
Right, right. Exactly.
All right. Well, we've got to take a little break right now. When we come back, these spicy lamb balls are not what I expected. This is How to Behave on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
You're listening to Broke Down by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Keep it locked here for more How to Behave.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Yes, scary.
Scary, yeah, that's the word.
Welcome back. This is How to Behave on the Heritage Radio Network. We are talking about how to behave when you are a food writer in the changing media landscape. Robert Sistema.
Close. Sistema.
Sistema.
Right.
I was practiced and I practiced and I practiced. Did you know that when you search for your name on Google Images, about half the images that come up are Michael Musto?
Oh, and the other half are Josh Ozersky. It's a wonderful.
Maybe a quarter. There, a quarter of them are actually you.
But in a mask or something.
In a mask,
right?
Yeah.
There's a couple of
a mask.
Rock era pictures of me, too, but I don't really look like that anymore.
Yeah, that's
I'm much more handsome now.
It's probably just because you and Musto were laid off on the same day that
that's
now
right,
suddenly.
Yes.
Your names are always side by side.
Well,
in
it
all
shows
the
how
news.
Dumb the internet is. I mean, it's crawling along trying to get this content and stick it all together, but it doesn't really care. If it sees your name in a caption, it'll pick up anybody's picture and just like barf it into the, you know, the Google search.
Yeah, it's true. So, tell us about the Organ Meat Society.
With pleasure. It started maybe 18 years ago or something. I'm not sure. You'd have to talk to the recording secretary as to the exact details. But it began when a couple of friends of mine, a couple of acquaintances at that time, asked me to advise this organization that they were just forming called the Organ Meat Society. It had other names, too, like the Awful Truth and all sorts of just revolting
really
names.
Bad
so,
ones.
Yes. And they asked me to be an advisor, and eventually I kind of found that I didn't want to just advise. And, of course, the reason they're asking me to be an advisor is that 18 years ago, organ meats were out of favor in most of the kind of doctrinaire expensive restaurants. Now you can go into, you know, any of Harold Dieterle's places and find marrow bones and maybe kidneys and all sorts of strange organ-bearing things. But back then, the best place to find organ meats, and still one of the best places, is in the city's ethnic restaurants. You know, you go to Uzbeki place, and you might find a lamb tail fat kebab.
Yeah.
You go to a Mexican place, and you've got great tripe and maybe kibitza. You know, it's like the French, the tête de veau or something.
Yeah, the one time you and I met previous to this was on a quest, a small group of people on a quest for lamb balls and bull penis at a Chinese place.
That's right, in a place that no longer exists, but it was out in Flushing, I believe.
That's too bad. Yeah, and they weren't very. The meal was great. Those two dishes were not particularly.
No, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for organ eating, but it's always interesting because a lot of times, you know, you never realize that there's no muscles in a penis. It's like a hydraulic thing. It's all like it's all gristly.
Robert, do you think that the organ meat society had any influence in mainstreaming them on menus.
I would certainly hope so, because part of the thing that we were doing was sometimes having like above ground chefs and stuff cook organ meat meals, and people like, I think, Mari Batali cooked once for us, and a bunch of other chefs. And I think just getting the organs into the dialogue, and also the Organ Meat Society is kind of like a hook. It's kind of like, yeah. You know, you would say, "Whoa, what a wild idea," I guess.
But you weren't just doing it for enjoyment. You were actually promoting organ meats and stuff?
No, it was for enjoyment. I mean, the beauty of organ meats is that everyone has a different relationship to them. Everyone probably likes at least one.
Everyone has a story.
Yeah, my mother used to serve liver and onions, you know, even though liver is obviously an organ meat and quite skanky tasting. Yeah. But, you know, I love tripe, cow tripe.
Yeah.
And I hate brains. Brains are, like, disgusting. So, but it's really fun when the Organ Meat Society eats brains. Man, I'll tuck into those deep fried.
Have you never had brains that you enjoyed?
No, they're too gross. They're kind of custardy. And
because
it's,
I feel
the
like
texture turns me off.
The texture turns me off, too.
It looks like a brain.
But tripe is gross, too, unless it's prepared well by a good chef.
Yeah, or unless you like the skanky flavor of badly washed tripe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kidneys are a real breaking point here. I mean, you can either make kidneys taste not like piss or like piss, and some people prefer one or the other.
Some people prefer piss?
I would say so. Probably the people that are kind of into golden showers or something like that. I mean, yeah, who knows what the...
That's a different show.
I want to ask some advice as a young writer. I have a group of writer friends, and we were debating whether it's okay to write something for a publication for free, or whether that's sort of setting a bad example for oneself as well as for other food writers.
You want to take that one, Melissa?
Sure. I used to have this discussion with fellow writer friends regarding the Atlantic online, I think for a period, I'm not sure if it's still the case, where drink writers and what have you would end up writing, and it was sort of a means of almost promoting a brand, and I think it really depends on the venue. I think that overall the practice has really cheapened writing as a profession, because, you know, I know that if Robert's not writing and there's a freelancer, that person may make a couple hundred dollars if they're lucky, you know, and that's not something to make a living on, and that essentially ends up silencing people's voices or making essentially making things less strong in terms of how people are talking about food. So I find it really problematic, but I can see why a starting writer would do that.
Yeah, it seems like if the standard for the industry is that people who aren't getting paid or aren't getting paid much are doing all the writing, that the quality is going to drop because it's not going to be professional.
You're right. I mean, the quality has dropped already. I mean, the worst part about that is that publications like The Village Voice start thinking that copy is nothing. It's like almost free. Mm-hmm. It's like everywhere. Who cares if you get someone that can turn a phrase or who can't turn a phrase? It makes no difference. It's just like writing is the crap that you fill up the vessel with, and they don't really, you know, and there's still great writing, and you can always find great writing, but I would say the general level of writing has declined in food publications across the board.
I had this brief stint as a guest editor for Grub Street when I was living in Philadelphia, and I had to write 6 posts a day, and I feel like that challenge in Philadelphia, which is like not New York, it's a relatively small town, left me without any chance of writing anything decent.
Yeah. So what do you guys think? Let's start with you, Robert. What do you think about the future of food writing? What should we expect? What looks good about the future? What looks bad? What scares you?
What looks good about the future, and this one may sound apocalyptic, is that the age of foodism is going to decline. The obsession with food as the one and only thing that you spend your money on and obsess over is going to go the way of the dodo. It's going to disappear. It's going to go back to being... it's a bubble. It's like any speculative bubble. You know, bankers are pouring money into these, like, restaurants that can never succeed.
Which is
the
why...
The half-life of a restaurant has declined from maybe 4 years to about 9 months.
Which is why you think it's so unconscionable for universities to be giving degrees in food writing.
But they do that all the time. I mean, they are money-making institutions. They've been turning out, you know, more doctors right. than the country needs.
More lawyers.
Who are now all working in Duane Reade as attending physicians. So, yes, no, there's the country is declining economically, and it's gradually going to be felt in the food business.
Like, so you think this is going to sound apocalyptic?
Yeah. Well, I look around me. And don't you sometimes like go to fancy restaurants and they're just like bistros, but they still want about $75 a piece out of you?
Yeah.
And you look around you and you say, who the hell are all these people paying this much money?
Yeah. What I've discovered is that if I go out and I eat like I eat and drink like I drink, I'm going to spend $60-$65
oh, yeah.
at a crummy restaurant.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I can get a world-class meal that knocks my socks off for $75. So I either get like a $2 taco, or I spend the extra $10 and get a
That's
really
right.
great meal. I don't understand how these things in the middle that are doing mediocrity.
Yeah, and 5 years from now,
people who don't know or don't care. I think we all really care deeply about food, and then a lot of people just don't
care.
Well, the thing is, when Guy Fieri's gone, you can still care about food,
of
and
course.
It will be kind of more meaningful.
He's not gone
than
already.
When everyone is walking down the street having conversations on their cell phones about their, you know, about foie gras and about, like, eating at the latest bistro or whatever.
Okay, quickly, Melissa, what are your thoughts on the future of food writing and food journalism?
I think that increasingly people will be directed toward places like Lucky Peach or something like Modern Farmer, that it's going to be segmented and that there will be fewer opportunities for a wider audience to be reading compelling food writing or compelling food criticism, because, I mean, I feel lucky in terms of my newspaper that I'm so supported by my editors, but I think that's really Wayne.
Do you know if for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, is this a financially sound business model that maybe could be a model for other publications, that there actually is a demand for this kind of good writing?
I certainly hope so. I don't know that I'm the expert to answer that question. So,
well, part of
so
the reason is the very nature of Pittsburgh, which is like Chicago in some ways, is that it is kind of isolated, has its own food culture, people that care passionately about it and have forever, and who, you know, boost the local economy and the local foodways. So, you know, that I think it's a unique situation there. There aren't too many cities that would be as supportive of those sorts of critical endeavors as Pittsburgh is.
Yeah, but there are a few cities. There are a few cities. All right. Well, Hannah, do you have any? Do you have a last question for Robert and Melissa before we hit the road?
It's not very exciting to end. Well, I shouldn't preface my question by saying something. Okay.
This is lame.
Here's a lame question. No, here's like a dilemma from the other side of fence. Back in when I was managing a restaurant, we got a call from a food blogger who would like to have like a free meal for two with like four courses. What's the proper response to this request?
If you could reach your hand through the phone and punch them, you should.
My boss
that.
Wanted to say yes to her, but I felt like, really? For real?
I own a restaurant. I think anybody who asks, we love to give away free stuff in general, but not to people who ask for it. And certainly nobody who's going to review you should ask for free stuff. I think that's unethical.
Completely.
You agree?
Oh, Robert? God, yes.
Pretty gross.
Yeah, yeah so you...
Gross. So we're all
But that's what this age has wrought, is that exactly. sort of behavior on the part of kind of people that feel privileged.
Yeah, and they think we're weird when we say no. Like, they don't understand. Have you ever seen anybody write something negative because they didn't get the free meal?
No, but I've seen them write something bad.
Write something badly?
One of the things that seems like... I've talked to a lot of staff from restaurants, and they were talking about how much they notice people dining in restaurants writing in to Yelp or wherever else as they're there, or instead of asking the sommelier a question, they're looking it up on their phone. And so I think that one of the sidelines of the way that food journalism is sort of unraveling is having much more interaction with this like crowdsourcing kind of thing that has to do with food writing rather than interacting, like interacting with staff or having people read like mainstream newspapers about food.
It's like the contrast between Wikipedia and true knowledge.
Yeah,
exactly. Wow. Exactly.
Well, this has been sort of depressing.
Right. Sorry.
Thank you so much. No, unfortunately, we're going to have to end on that note. I'm a little more optimistic. I think that the cream will rise to the top, that we're going to have to wade through a lot of garbage to find the good writing, but I think the good writing will still
exist.
I'll
be so excited for it.
Well,
so hungry, hungry
on.
For yeah. the good writing.
Yeah, put your hip boots on and log on
wade
to the
through the buttermilk.
Yeah. We'll see there.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for today.
Thanks, Hannah and Brian.
Thank you so
thank
much,
you.
Robert Sistema
so
and Melissa McCart of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And to the woman who resigned in protest when she was told about her own impending layoff, Hannah Howard. The How to Behave theme is courtesy of John Lindbaum and Big Five Chord. Check them out at BigFiveChord.com. Thanks to Joe Galarraga for engineering today's show. You can always find episodes of How to Behave and lots of other great shows at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm Brian Kaiser, and apropos of nothing except me spending last weekend drinking in New Orleans, remember, never mix, never worry. This is How to Behave on the Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.